the Anime That Didn't Make Us, a podcast about anime that we could have been nostalgic for if not for the curse of geography. I'm Brian Smith, and there's no Anthony Askew. He played too much Death Stranding, and he can't play podcasting anymore. But I am joined by Screen Tone Club's very own Elliot Page.
Hey, how's it going?
Not too bad. Anthony dropped this on us fairly late, so we didn't even have a chance to drag Dwayne into the process.
Hey, gamer posture is an ongoing disease that blights many of us.
Yes, I mean, I've got back problems, but they're not self-inflicted. So we're going to have to try and do three episodes without Anthony. So we're going to have to try and remember what happened in Virus without his assistance. But we are talking today about three anime. First up, we've got Dankuga. Then we've got Might Gainer. I think that's how it's supposed to be pronounced. That's how they
you got it.
But sometimes it feels like they're trying to say Might Gay. But
I think it depends on the voice actor and how excited they are at the time.
I think you're correct. And Virus Buster Surge. It's a Masami Obari-related triple bill. And we start with Dankuga, Super Beast Machine God from 1985. It's an original mecha anime that ran for 38 episodes, produced by Ashi Productions for TBS. Coming as it did near the start of the OAV market, it was followed by a succession of OAV one-offs, specials, and series. The final one of which was released in 1990. A sequel series, produced by the aforementioned Masami Obari, Dankuga Nova, was aired on satellite channel Animax in 2007. As I said, the series is notable because it's the debut of Masami Obari, though according to the Google spreadsheet that I found while searching my emails, which was a little worrying, I assume, if you've got a public document on your Google Drive, you could just have it found by people searching emails?
Yeah, I mean, Google integrates everything nowadays anyway. You know, it's getting spookier by the day.
Yeah, it was a bit, because I don't think I was even searching for Dankuga in my emails. So I was searching, I was trying to find out exactly what the three titles were. So no, I was looking for Dankuga, and they brought up a document. Anyway, so somebody has made a document of notable animators who worked on each episode. And apparently he did not work on this episode, though he did supply mecha designs for the series. And as it's available from Discotech and on Crunchyroll, let's hear what they say about the show. The Zorbardos Muge Empire commences their initial attack on Earth and eliminates nearly all the planet's defense forces. All that stands in their way is a newly formed special mobile division, the Cyber Beast Force. In the series, not in this episode.
So not appearing into this episode.
I believe the robots don't even combine till about halfway through the show.
Oh, great. So all the cool stuff that it tries to tease you with in the intro doesn't actually show up.
No, this is even worse than Dorvac was. Dorvac's problem was they didn't name any of the robots till about 17 minutes in.
Wow. Damn, I can't tell if that's keeping your powder dry or forgetting.
Like, well, the toy company who opened to sell toys off it went out of business after that show, so.
that seems like a case of suicide, or murder, I suppose. Yes. Just toy company murder. This episode spends a lot of time on what is likely going to become the antagonist or rival character, who basically consumes every scene that he's in. Which, you know, with a name like, hang on, where is it? Shapario Keats. Yes.
We'll get to that before we find out exactly what I was doing instead of watching this on Friday the 5th of April, 1985. Elliot, how old would you have been on Friday the 5th of April, 1985?
Minus 3 months.
Okay.
I can't count. Minus 5 months.
Okay. I would have been 9 years old. So exactly the right audience for this sort of nonsense. But instead, it was a Good Friday, so I'd have been home from school, and I'd have been watching Battle of the Planets, first thing on BBC. So I would have got some anime, at the very least. It was an episode called Rockets Out of Control. Then...
That sounds like a really good 9-year-old TV episode name.
Yes. Then it was Agaton Sax. which was a series of books that I had completely forgotten until this week when I was writing these notes up that I loved. And I think this is an unlabeled Jack and Dory repeat. There is an Agatha and Sax cartoon, but as far as I know, it was never translated into English. Instead, apparently the Kenneth Williams Jack and Dory episodes of Agatha and Sax were so popular, they would just rebroadcast them under the name Agatha and Sax on the BBC.
Hmm.
So that's probably how I first encountered it, and then I probably got all the books out of the library following that. So I could add that to Doctor Who and the Moomins as books I would have read as a child. Oh, Dick King Smith books as well.
Oh yeah, totally.
Very picky reader though. If I read one thing in a series, I'd want to read everything in that series. Then you had Why Don't You, the show which tried to get you to not watch television. Where apparently they were out and about in the Museum of Transport in Glasgow. Play School, I've been too old for Play School at this point. Then, as it was Good Friday, you'd have a bunch of religious programming. And then later on in the day, you'd got Hokey Cokey. That's another seesaw program, so that's for like preschool children. A Bugs Bunny cartoon. The Amazing Captain Nemo. Which is a film. I feel like every time I've watched something about Captain Nemo, I found them incredibly boring. Don't think I really liked the character until Alan Moore's League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Mm.
Then we had Donald Duck's 50th birthday, where Dick Van Dyke celebrates Donald Duck's Golden Jubilee. With a introduction from Clarence Nash, who had just died.
recorded before he died, sure.
Yes, presumably they also aired this in America while he was still alive, and we've just got it in the UK at this point. Guest celebrities include R2-D2, C-3PO, Henry Winkler, Kenny Rogers, Donna Summer, and Bruce Jenner.
Jesus. Yeah. They made a time capsule.
It is, yes. Then an enchanting feature film for all the family, The Water Babies. That was another film I never wanted to watch.
I had the book as a child given to me by one of my crazier aunts, and I remember I don't remember a single thing about it, but I remember it being a bit freaky. Something about, and I know I received a copy of that at some point, but it got chucked into a jumble sale at some point.
Wikipedia now tells me that it was written as part satire in support of Charles Darwin's The Origin of the Species. Well, that would have been lost at me as a 9-year-old.
Yeah, totally.
I think I would have found it deeply slow, and even if it's got Bernard Cribbins, that would still not be enough for me. Then something called Circus of Youth, a special international circus of young artists from home and overseas who have inherited their crafts and skills from a generation of circus families.
That sounds like a front for a Jeffrey Epstein thing. I don't know.
Well, I believe this is probably... Essentially, This is Variety, but this is still while circuses would get on TV. But these sort of acts would now be on Britain's Got Talent, wouldn't they?
Oh yeah, totally.
Because that's what a lot of these acts do. They go around all the Got Talents around the world and do their stint there. Because it's Variety in disguise.
Yeah. Just more atomized and less organized together.
Yes. Then we've got A Song for Europe 1985. A program to choose the song that will represent United Kingdom at the Eurovision Song Contest. We've got Vicky with Love Is, Peter Beckett with I'm Crying, Alvin Stardust with The Clock on the Wall, James Oliver with What We Say in Our Eyes, Des Dyer with Energy, Annabelle with Let Me Love You One More Time, Kerry Wells with Dancing in the Night, Mike Redway and Fiona Kennedy with So Do I. So I did look up who had won. It was Vicky with Love Is. So then I looked at YouTube and I was like, I do not remember this. Oh, hang on, I do remember that bit of the chorus. But it's, I don't think this did very well either in the contest or in the charts. I think the only thing of interest I had, oh, there was Odd One Out after that. That was one of Paul Daniels' quiz shows.
Oh, wow. Man, Paul Daniels.
A frequent appearance on this podcast where we look at...
Oh, well, because he's everywhere. Yes. you couldn't stop the guy.
Well, to be fair, at least he's not one of the ones where we have to go, and now this week's sex offender.
It's almost a blessing that he's fallen out of, like, conversation, that it's like, oh, thank God he can quietly go to the night. We don't have to worry about him suddenly having a skeleton closet.
I can't remember what I definitely watched it, but I cannot remember the format of that show at all. And then a Dad's Army repeat, and then I probably would have been sent to bed at this point. BBC Two had got a Tom Sawyer film. I think that was the only thing of interest for children on the BBC Two that day. Your number one is Easy Lover. The UK number one is Easy Lover by Phil Bailey and Phil Collins, which I think still holds up as a song.
I don't know Phil Bailey, but I obviously know Phil Collins. Phil Bailey doing anything else?
Philip Bailey is, I don't want to say which band. Okay, my thought was correct. Yes, he's one of the lead singers with Earth, Wind and Fire.
Oh, totally. That's cool. Okay, that's good.
Yeah. I wouldn't have known that at the time. That's a thing I learned later, and then I just didn't trust my memory there to come out and say it. So on to what I could have been watching if I was in Japan that very day. So first up, the episode title is Empire's Desire, and I've annoyingly not looked up the credits of these people for my show. I think I've done it for everybody else's. Our director is Seiji Okuda. What else did he work on? Crystal Triangle. Oh, there you go. Sign of quality.
Oh my God.
Dream Hunter Rem.
Oh my God. Those are all things I watched because, like, Anime World Order back in the far off year of 2008 recommended me. I watched them and I did, and I was really upset.
I think I very recently watched Dream Hunter Rem for some research into a possible panel, but not one this year. Offside. Not much. Urashiman. There you go. There's the other good thing he's done.
Oh, there's the thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Otherwise a lot of curious things. Now, screenplay is by Keisuke Fujikawa. Right, I'm gonna have to. This is bad planning. There's always one thing I miss the research on every episode. I should have a checklist, really. So this guy, what else did this guy write? He did Die Rugger 15, which I think you can now watch on YouTube for free. Gold Mars. He did the brain design on Odin. Don't know what that is. I mean, I know what Odin is. I don't know what the brain design is. And a bunch of Star Blazers scripts.
Okay, fair enough. So he got work.
Yes, yeah, I know. Yeah, he's done work. Yeah, but storyboard is Mitsukazu Yamatane, and the episode director is Seiji Okuda and Jutaro Obaa. Now, the character design list is insane because they've got so many different character designers for the different characters.
Yeah, and the thing that's kind of, I don't know, almost charming is that they're all highly unmoored from each other and highly unmoored from, like, the background radiation, like the background characters, and, like, the fantastical mech designs are also unmoored from the, like, obviously earthbound mech designs. So it's like lots of combinations of boring ass stuff, but also like some characters who look like they're from entirely different series or entirely different plot lines almost. Like, I swear to God, like, you have like the main character, you have like, Shapiro Keats, who is the main sort of character, who again has his own character designer, his girlfriend, who looks like an entirely different, like, joke. Like, she almost looks like a joke character someone would draw for an anime girl.
She's very anime.
It's big eyes, big hair constantly swaying in the wind. Where does the hair go when she has a helmet on? We don't know, but it has to go somewhere. It makes it really kind of confusing. It's slightly not confusing, but it just makes it a real funny watch about these characters should not be together. Like, what's going on?
Yeah, the character designer for Sara is Sanai Kobayashi, and the only other thing they do character design for is Roots Search. It's a strange show. Mecha design is by Hisashi Hirai and Masami Obari. And our leads are, we've got Shinobu Fujiwara, played by Kazuki Yao, the voice of Frankie from One Piece. Shapiro Keats, voiced by Norio Wakamoto. Cell from Dragon Ball, and distinctly Norio. I was like, is that Norio Wakamoto?
Yeah, his, like, by his second line, I was thinking, it's either a sound alike or it's just Norio Wakamoto consuming scenery. And there he is.
Playing a teenage pilot. Sara Yuki, played by Yuriko Yamamoto, the voice of Yuria from Fist of the North Star. And the one person who doesn't feel cast against type. Now, I guess maybe Kazuki Yao had got a type at this point, but the type he turned out to have was definitely not this sort of character.
Yeah, the endlessly irritating hot blood character.
Yes. And our songs are Aiyo Far Away by Rie Fujiwara, who debuted in 1985. And she also plays Laura Sullivan in the show, a character who is not in this episode. After her idol career she became part of the initial iteration of sexy group CC Girls in 1990, and then formed the rock duo Re-Scramble, and nowadays she's an assistant stage director and choreographer.
Okay.
And I can't remember the opening theme at all, nor the ending theme. I will get to the only thing I really remember about this show is being annoyed about the characters and the amount of shit which explains. don't know whether that shit causes Burning Love, the ending theme by Takeshi Ike, who had been part of the group He Story in the 70s. And this was his solo debut. And later in his career, he composed music for shows such as Dragon Ball Z and Fancy La La. So, what happens in this episode? Oh boy. As I say, lots of stuff blows up. But let me look at my notes and tell you exactly. So, opens up with the bad guys doing their register for the day. Death Gaia here, Gildorum here, Helmut here. And they all assure their Emperor Muge that they will lead the attack on Galaxy Sector 5, aka Earth. In this scene, there's a suspiciously looking human woman, or suspiciously human looking woman, rather, with the Emperor, who I'm going to guess is going to turn face down the line. Because everybody else is like a big green weird. Well, they're humanoid, but they're big green weirdos.
Yeah, this is the point where the different character designers actually really work, because they all look like weird ass, like lieutenants from different series. So it looks really cool. I mean, frankly, the high point of this entire episode for me was Death Gaia, like just that name, and I was like, oh shit, this is great. Oh no, never mind.
Yeah, so by the time you get to Helmet, it seems a bit like a bit of a letdown from the first two names. Meanwhile, cut to Australia, where we learn that Earth already knows these invaders are coming. And we are at a military academy, where ace pilot Shinobu Fujiwara is getting mad that there's snogging going on the landing strip. So he flies down and yells at Shapiro Keats and Sara Yuki, the two other trainee pilots who are getting romantically involved. But then we get a war montage as the Earth is invaded by robots and it gets blown up real good.
Yeah. Both on Earth. And it's like almost the third narrator line is, oh yeah, all the military's got completely boned. It's just flattening entirely. And then it skips out to space where, oh, they're also getting boned there. Never mind.
And the Zorbados Muge Empire demands surrender. And Shapiro Keats approaches the military leaders. He's got a plan, but they don't want to hear about it. We never learn what his plan is. Partly because he keeps a lot of this stuff to himself. At this point, I was like, Kazuki Yaoi as the young male lead is weird, and it's even weirder than Norio Wakamoto as an evil Bishonen.
It doesn't really work for one regard, is the fact that your first interaction with the character of him being upset at PDA, but then also all the mechanics hate him because he's like, hurry up and fix my jet, and they're like, You're a prick. You broke your jet. Like, we're not going to fix it any faster. So immediately don't like the main character.
And yeah, the generals basically tell the kids, well, you're going to have to rely on courage now, because clearly our military might is not good enough to beat these aliens.
At least they're efficient. Like, they've already got a resistance going, even though it's been approximately 6 hours since they all got owned. And the general basically going, oh, we have to disband the academy. And someone says, disband the academy. And it's like, dude, you're in a rubble strewn wasteland. There's nothing left. Like, well, go.
Well, it's not yet a rubble strewn wasteland. Cause first of all, we have an alien dogfight. The first attack on the academy.
Yeah.
And Shinobi was like, oh, you want a dogfight? I'll show you how to dogfight. And he realizes if he turns off the computers in the jets, the aliens can't predict their maneuvers. And then we get the eye catch, which teases a robot that we would not see this week. More stuff blows up. Shapiro, at this point, decides that his air combat skills means that he can rule the entire universe, which is a pretty big leap in logic.
Yeah, he's gone from making out with the, like, female main character to, I will become a god. And yes. It's like, okay, dude. I was expecting him to get blown up, honestly. I thought, man, if he gets blown up, that's going to be like, you know, pineapple salading someone really fast.
Shinobi faces a really big robot, well, bigger than the previous robots or jets that the aliens have sent down, while Shapiro and Sara fly off into space. Shinobi tells Sara that he'll shoot her down if she doesn't stop following Shapiro. She doesn't, and so he does. Shapiro then flies out of the atmosphere, presumably off to rule the entire universe. Back at the base, Sara looks sad, and then slaps Shinobu for thinking that Shapiro sold them out. The top brass are waiting around. What's the UN's decision? Do we carry on fighting? Do we surrender? Shinobu walks in and says, Our leader's gone, Shapiro. Did he die? No, he defected. Again, zero proof that that's what he did.
Yeah, only you as the reader really know that, or the watcher really know that that's probably what he's done.
Yes. But even as the watcher, it's not particularly, I mean, it is what he will do during the series, but it does not appear to be fully clear in this episode that that's what he's doing. It feels like this character's ahead of where the writers are.
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, even in his first scene, he's already like figured out everything like 15 minutes in the future. So you're just kind of left training behind this complete arsehole.
He then gets anime youth mad at the generals and the admirals and the other brass, which again seems weird in this voice. It's like this scene with somebody else to be it would probably work. It just feels weird. It just feels like miscast. Then we cut to Shapiro. He's being tortured by the aliens, but he is refusing to talk to anyone but the Emperor. Because basically, in the same way that Shinobu's leapt to the conclusion that Shapiro's defected, the aliens have leapt to the much more reasonable conclusion that this guy hasn't defected, he's actually here as a secret saboteur.
Yeah, another really good idea that someone should have actually done for real, instead of just leaving it up to, like, Norio Komodo to defect.
Then Shinobu and Sara have a terrible heart-to-heart in which absolutely nothing is resolved, and thankfully aliens arrive to blow shit up to cut the tension. This is where, yeah, the base is reduced to rubble at this point, and Shinobu saves Sara's life by pushing her to the ground, and that's saving her life, apparently. The Empire land their HQ near the Great Lakes in America. And we find that Shinobu has been assigned to Japan as part of the resistance, where Japan's super technology has created a special forces group called Cyber Beast Force. So that's your hook to get you in. It's like, oh, that sounds cool. And that robot looked cool in the eye catch. And Shinobu waits to ship out, and Sara thanks him for stopping her from being blown up. And then he hops into a jeep and presumably drives all the way from Australia to Japan. Because he's just driving for the rest of the episode. And that was it. A whole lot of stuff blew up in this episode. And it really felt like they just wanted to animate shit blowing up. And didn't really care about any other thing apart to do with the series.
Yeah, they basically wanted to show off the, like, alien robot designs they had, which were quite cool, but then it's just a case of like, oh, we just want to blow all these jets up, hooray. And then like I said, my main note is like, what, there's no robot, come on, like, it's, yeah. it makes you wonder, it's like, was Japan just waiting for everyone else to get blown up first? It's just like, oh good, we can rise from the ashes or something.
I think that might be part of the appeal of it in Japan, now we've got to go to Japan, they'll save us. But I think really how well animated some of the explosions are, they do that, I assume, oh, I don't know when they first did, but it's that sort of like, oh, here's an image which is color, but the explosion is so bright and devastating, it blows all the color off the cell as the thing's being destroyed. There's a few shots of that, and they say lots of dogfighting stuff, which obviously was popular post Macross. I mean, if you want the action, this is probably, from looking at that document, this is probably not even the best episode for action. But if you want anything else, boy, you're on stony ground, unless you really want to hear Norio Akamoto, be all romantic for a little bit. But we'll see where we feel about this when we pick which show we'll send back in time to our younger selves to watch as a child. Now, let's go to Elliot's choice. 1993's The Brave Express Might Gain. Gainer, even. Might Gainer is a original mecha anime that aired for 47 episodes in 1993. Produced by Sunrise for TV Asahi, it forms the fourth installment of the Brave series of robot shows designed to sell toys for Takara, and the third one that we've covered on this podcast. What happens in this? Well, 50 years after the fossil fuel ran out, humanity has bounced back, particularly in Nouvelle Tokyo City. However, crime continues, now assisted by giant robots. And when the police cannot cope, billionaire high school student Maito Senpuji and his robot pal Gainer step in to help. And this originally aired Saturday, the 30th of January, 1993. But what was Elliot watching then? How old would you have been in Saturday, 30th of January, 1993?
I would have been 8. So
I would have been 17. So you could have woken up and watched Henry's Cat at 7:30. Do you remember Henry's Cat? I remember Henry's Cat.
I remember Henry's Cat, but I must admit, at this time of my life, I was mostly just hogging the Skybox because my parents were hideous and had a Sky, and ended up just watching Nickelodeon nonstop.
Okay. Then there's something called Whiz Bang, fun and laughter to start the day.
I remember that. Yeah, that was good fun.
Okay. Well, I have no idea what that is.
I think it was like a magic-themed bunch of shorts, if I remember correctly. Okay. I don't know. It's been a while.
The little bits, actual anime for you. Then we got Eggs and Baker. Cheryl Baker goes back to school as a dinner lady.
Oh, God. Man, Cheryl Baker, where is she now?
Probably touring with the Books Fizz that they can't call Books Fizz. They've got like a, they've had because of, the guy from Dollar ended up with the rights to the name Books Fizz, and so the people who were in Books Fizz have to perform under a different name, if I remember correctly.
Alright, yeah, that sounds like a showbiz thing.
Yeah. I think this was a cooking show for kids, wasn't it? Eggs and Baker. Tom and Jerry, 25 minutes of cartoon classics. Let's hope they were Hanna-Barbera era.
Yeah, the weirder stuff.
Yes. Then, Going Live, where your guests were high-flying rugby star Rory Underwood and comedian Bobby Davro.
God, Bobby Davro, Jesus. That's a name I've not thought about for a long, long time.
I bet he was about to start, he must have had his show on where he would do impressions of other people's comedy characters, I think was around this time, which just does not seem the dumb thing. To be a comedian and go on and do an impression of a Harry Enfield character.
Yeah, it just sounds like stealing. Yes. I think they fight over things like that.
The cartoons you could have watched on this episode were The Chipmunks and Pirates of Darkwater. Not a fan of either.
No.
Then you had Grandstand. And then evening, you had That Show Business, the Mike Smith entertainment quiz where two teams of celebrities would answer questions. This week it's Neil Morrissey and Birds of a Feather's Leslie Joseph versus comedian Nick Revel and Terry Christian off of The Word.
Man. God. I remember Birds of a Feather and I remember my parents watched that religiously, so a lot of those skits are ingrained in my head. sadly.
Then you've got Noel Edmonds' house party, or Noel's house party. This time, Shaw Taylor is the gotcha. When did Noel's house party start? 91. It almost ran the entire decade. 91.
Yeah, if it was a British TV show that was British TV for that decade, it would be Noel's house party, I think.
Yeah,
in a weird, depressing manner.
Yeah, I used to know somebody at university who that was her favourite TV show of all time.
Oh, that's a bad yearbook thing. Like, that's the sort of thing you say about someone to diss them.
Then we had Paul Daniels' magic show, where the guests are Lady Quadro, a contortionist from Germany, Rodolfo Reese from Italy, and Swedish card star Lennart Green, with Debbie McGee. So again, this is kind of the equivalent of that circus show from my day.
Yeah.
Casualty, a ram raid has a devastating effect on a young family. And Ash discovers that bullying is not confined to the playground.
Don't get me wrong, love Casualty, but man alive, it really drives home how ad lib it is. Like, Mad Libs, you know, you can just drop words in.
Well, I assume the second part was probably some part of, deliberate, ploy to make workplace bullying a topic on people's minds, to help people recognize when it's happening in their own workplace.
Oh yeah, Casualty, God bless it, always does the educational element where, you know, it feels like it's about 6 months behind the tide, but it's still getting in before it's too more blasé and boring.
And then an episode of Birds of a Feather. Been sorted. Another chance to see episodes from the first series. So repeats then.
Yep.
And I don't think there was anything of interest on BBC Two. Let me have a quick look. It may have just been all sports all the time. No, it was a whole load of old films. Yeah, okay, there we go.
Yeah, BBC Two.
BBC Two in the 80s and the 90s, probably the 70s as well. I mainly remember that sort of thing of being stuck at my grand's, but at 17, that would not have been the case. UK number one was still I Will Always Love You by Whitney Houston.
Yeah, because that was there for like a year, wasn't it? Or something stupid?
Some ridiculously long time. I should probably look it up because it's probably going to come up multiple times as we do the podcast.
Yeah, I remember it being number one for a god-awful amount of time. Also, I remember, like, because that was with The Bodyguard, the film, right?
Yes.
My dad was a massive fan of that thing for some reason. I don't know why. Maybe he fancied himself as the bodyguard, even though he did not have the body for it whatsoever. But yeah, he loved that film. You think he still does. He's got Blu-ray somewhere at home. Of all the films, like, cause it's like, you know, it's like dad films, but then he also loves The Bodyguard, so God knows what's going on there. Bless him.
Never seen the film.
It's very boring. Nothing really happens. It's a masturbatory fantasy where you get to, like, protect the world's hottest lady and she falls in love with you. There you go. You're done.
Full chart history for I Was Always Loved. It was 10 weeks at number one.
Oh, okay. It felt like longer, probably because my dad was singing it.
It was on the charts for 32 weeks, though.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
God, there's been a lot of versions of it. I didn't know.
Hell
Rick,
yeah.
Rick Waller did a version. Which got to number six. So, this episode is called... I thought I'd written this down.
The reputed Mike Gine.
That's it, yes. The thing they repeatedly say throughout the episode.
By the third time it came up, I started laughing at it constantly because it's not like they don't get to legendary status. It's just reputed. It's like, oh, you have a reputation. It's like, thanks. I'm a giant robot.
He is directed by Shinji Takamatsu, who also would do Jay Decker and Goldarn for the Brave series, and would direct Gintama and Cute High Earth Defense Club in more recent years.
Good work.
Screenplay by Takeo Koyama, best known for Dragon Ball Z, and kind of responsible for most anime screenwriters in the 90s. A lot of them trained under him.
Mm.
And had him for management, I think, as well. Storyboard by Shinji Takamatsu as well. Naoki Hishikawa directed this episode. He's never directed his own series, but he's still working today. He's recently been working on Aruma-kun, And character design is by Akira Aguru, who the only other credit they've got for character design is Generator Gall. And Atsuko Ishida, who would also work on Jadeka, Goldarn, and Dagon, and Rhea. She's one of these character designers who's incredibly 90s.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I picked up, they recently released the manga of Re-Earth, and it probably come to a future podcast that I'm going to record, but just opening a single page of Re-Earth, and it's like, oh, yeah, I remember the 90s. God damn, look at these chins.
Mechanical Design is being a sunrise show of a certain era, which is all of time, is Kunio Okawara. Yeah. And opening animation features Masami Obari, thus keeping up the theme of the episode. Our opening theme is Arashi no Hero by Yuzuru Oka, only one other anime song, the guest out OAV ending theme. Otherwise, no details on her at all, not even on Discogs. Career disappeared. Likewise, the ending theme, Kikan no Gold, I think this is the first ending theme, there's a whole bunch of them. I think even we get ones sung by a villain at some point.
Oh, that sounds great.
Again, barely anything out there on this woman. They are on Discogs, unlike Yuzuru Oka, for a song on a Todd Rundgren cover album in 1997. So, beyond that, this is probably the thing they're best known for. Really, when you look their names up, this is what you get, is various YouTube videos and other video services of these two opening themes. So, tell us what happens in Big O's Big Brother.
Basically.
Brave Express Might Guider.
So it opens up on a normal sort of city metropolis. The police are in a standoff with a criminal gang, and the criminal gang have a rather petite robot. They're in the middle of robbing a bank, and I didn't write down the name. A hella, what's it? Oh God, I can't believe I've forgotten this, but what's the name of the cop in Lupin? You know, the
Zenigata.
You get a Zenigata style dude who's not as cool as Zenigata, Ozawa, who is trying his best to stop crime, even though the criminals have a giant robot. And the police have a robot. It looks like a dog. It looks like a weird little sort of Bernard Russell, like big ear dog. It's garbage. It gets flung away. The criminals start stealing money when suddenly, not suddenly, but you get a talking robot train, which is Gain itself. Is driving along, and there's also, the child 15-year-old character, Maito Senpuji, who has his own jet, who gets there first on interference and generally diss the criminals. Mike Gain shows up, transforms into a humanoid robot, and shows the criminals what for, gets them arrested, money returned, etc. Which honestly is like a hella sweet 6 minutes, like a potted 6 minute version of this show. Which was really good fun just because it gives you what you want to right at the start. But then it settles in and you remember there's more episode left. Whoops. So Maito, who is an insufferable billionaire child, tries to seduce like this lady. I think she's like a dispatcher or something, where he starts to trying out, like one-liners on her, which is where he gives himself nicknames and lines, and it's atrocious. No, don't do that. Don't be a lamer. But it also introduces the villain for this episode, which is Wolfgang, who is Dr. Hell, but budget Dr. Hell, who doesn't look quite as cool. Yeah, he's got dog ears. I didn't get that bit. I thought, is he an elf? No, it's got dog ears. But he's got like a cool coat, and he's got like about... Also, he's only got about 10 minions, so he's not doing that well. You know, he's got about 10 dudes.
Yeah, he's a bit Franken von Volger as well, in the curve of his beard.
Yeah, but he's not as cool as Franken von Volger, let's face it. No. But he's got a robot he's made called Ether 5656, which he kind of goes back and forth on whether it's an android or a robot, but eventually you see him pilot it, so robot, I guess. One thing about Mike going to mention quickly is it has a super AI. So it's actually its own existence, like it has its own sentience. In the first fight scene, Maito just sort of flies around and gets annoyed and annoys them all. So Wolfgang is a mad scientist who is in like a weird polluting factory who wants to steal electricity, apparently. And so he decides to, oh no, yeah, he says, oh, we're going to go to this power plant and steal the electricity. Has it been generated? Who knows? There's no oil, we get told. Maito comes home and he stood up his friend, because he's a prick, but he invites his friend around for a really lavish dinner, and it becomes apparent that Might is basically like, you know, a Batman main character, you know, Bruce Wayne, where he's a billionaire, his parents both died, he has this robot, he's the 1%, he's probably, I don't know. I started to get a bit creeped out by the series at this point, given my personal political leanings, therefore, oh, maybe we should just nationalize Mike Gine and get rid of this billionaire. But hey. Anyway, the butler gives a bunch of exposition. I kind of zoned out. And then, the electricity plant comes under attack by, Ether 5656 and Wolfgang piloting it with two flunkies. And it then cuts to a hospital that, they say it has its own generators, but not enough to keep the actual surgery rooms going. And so this little girl is terrified for her dad who's in surgery. So she gets on her bike and she rides off to the power plant to yell at the robot. She falls over. Might himself come to try and help out, because he can't stand injustice, yada yada. But he doesn't kind of get there. He's not that good. The robot is really, really big, like three times his size. And so he announces the Locomarzia. Marisa? Whatever. And he says Gatai, and that's when I perked up and started watching again, because a big old steam train looking robot thing runs over, or flies over, combines with Mike Gine, and it becomes like a big singular, you know, King of Braid style robot. And yeah. Then it wins. That's kind of, and then he gets a sword out of somewhere and he wins. And then, Ether is defeated, the evil robot. And so, you know, he then now apparently has, a new girlfriend, Yoshinaga Sally, who broke her ankle, because that's your fate of what's going to happen to you in these series. But everything's fine. Surgery goes okay. Rich kid goes home. Yada yada. Series is set up. And then there's the ending where it shows you more robots you should buy. And that's kind of it.
Then it shows you a bunch of all the villains who you're going to beat.
Who are way cooler.
I think it's Gainer when he's the robot, and then it's Might Gainer when he combines his flying plane with Gainer, and then he starts piloting Gainer, which is a whole thing. It's like, you were a sentient robot up until the point I combined with you, and now I'm piloting you.
Yeah, I mean, for the way it says that, oh, it's a super AI, it's like, maybe you should just let the robot get on with it? I don't know, whatever. Yeah, but no, it has all the elements you want. It has trains, very cool. It has a jet, very cool. It has a really irritating 15-year-old billionaire, not cool. But yeah, it does everything right. I mean, the thing that kind of makes this episode weird is it does the best version of it is the 6 minutes at the start where it has the like short version of it, and then it kind of just goes long and it's like, oh, it's still going. Shit.
The first part is very Pat Labor until, Gainer shows up, in that it's like the guys robbing the bank seem to be just using everyday construction robots to rob a bank, and say then, and then also the fact that the police show up with their robots on the back of a truck is totally Pat Labor, because that feels like what they're referencing there. And then the Ether robot is very giant robo.
Oh yeah, I think it's even got pretty big like beetle horns almost. Yes. Like it's big and red. It looks, I don't know, there's a lot going on with that robot, and you don't ever really seem to get a good shot of the whole thing at once because it's so big, which makes it seem really cool. Up until it gets completely owned.
Yeah, I liked the first episode of JDecker so much when we did it that I went to watch more episodes. I may watch more episodes of this, particularly because I know this has got a weird ending as a series. Which makes it the Big O comparison even more significant. But yeah, this was weird. I was like, I had to go and do a comparison on the Anime News Network thing, compare these two anime to just see how much crossover there was. There's a little bit of crossover, but not really in any of the major creative minds beyond it being a Sunrise show. But yeah, it's weirdly, or rather Big O's weirdly reminiscent of this.
The one thing the one thing that bedevils me the whole time watching it is that it looks like modern day for the time it was made, but then they reference that the oil ran out 50 years ago, and there's like elements of super technology that peaks in every now and then, but at the same time it's all got colossal throwbacks to like the 90s, where it's really solidly in there. Like, it kind of jumps around, not jumps around, but it just kind of takes what it wants and mashes them together and doesn't really care about the resulting product, which, you know, you don't want to spend forever boring kids with explaining your lore. But at the same time, it just jumps from like, oh, okay, you know, cool, like rather shitty police robot, looks like a puppy, to, oh, it's the train robot, cool, which is cool. Don't get me wrong. Like, if I was a kid, I would have totally loved this, because of the robots. But yeah, the jump between technology levels is really strange.
Well, I believe it will explain the lore a lot more going through the series. Yeah. And of course, the ultimate explanation is batshit insane. So,
all the world's a stage. Have fun.
Yes. So it doesn't matter.
Thanks for bringing all those toys, kids. Now prepare to have your mind broken.
Yes. Now, I really enjoyed this. The thing which struck me is I was like, the bit where he invites his mate round to his house and has put out his favourite foods, I was like, this is weirdly homoerotic. And is it only homoerotic because one of them is super rich?
It seems really, like, it seems weird because, like, obviously he's good friends with the other kid, and the other kid is very physical and sort of whacking him around the head and saying, oh, I can't stay angry at you. And then they have a conversation where they're trying to guess where the olives have come from. Like, I, again, maybe it's just me, but I kind of couldn't stand the main character. Just I'm like, oh, this kid should not exist. Someone needs to string this kid up and redistribute his wealth.
That's because you're not 10. I think when you're 10, yeah, you're supposed to think, that could be me when I'm 15. I could be super rich and have a giant robot.
Yeah, I don't know. Part of my brain also got broken by watching Berners Million, which was on TV, which was also about, hey, money's not all that important. I'm like, yeah. So,
well, this, I believe this does have the girlfriend character is, I think she's supposed to be like a juxtaposition to his super richness, is that she's super poor.
Yeah, because the hospital they're in sucks. Yeah. Like, they're in a real shit hospital.
So I don't know whether it has anything more to say or whether it's going to play it for jokes, because it is quite jokey. That's the other thing I really like about it. The character design, the mecha design, but also it's got a very light tone to it.
Oh, yeah, the detective Ozawa, I love him. Like, I love how he keeps turning up. He's got a heart of justice, but he doesn't have a giant robot, so he just gets bowled on his ass every time. But he's great. I love it. He's also the one who first says, is this the reputed Mike Gine? And it's like, yep, you're right. There he is. Yeah, good character. I love a good detective as the adult juxtaposition who's vaguely helpless, but you can't help but love.
Yeah, I think it's Jay Decker doesn't have the super rich kid situation as the problem, but it still does have the police robot that has the thing of, that we can only use this police robot with, the help of this child who's bonded to it. So therefore we're going to make this child the chief of police.
Damn. Man. That's also a good point. One thing about this as well is that the intro has so many cool robots in it. Like there's just like it's one part where it's like, oh, here's some cool robots and here's their combined form, here's another three cool robots in their combined form, and I'm there going like, holy shit, like these would be great toys, oh god. I feel like a 9-year-old already.
Yeah, that's what the Brave series is all about,
too. Basically,
let's cram it full as many toy robots as you possibly can.
Yep, and then you grow up to become 30 and you buy a 300-pound Gal Gaigar.
Yeah, luckily I never did that, but that's because I saw Gaigar probably when I was about 30, so.
Okay, well, I saw it when I was like 20 and I was like hot to trot on it. And then thankfully when that Soul of Chugokin came out, I was in the middle of, in between jobs. And so too poor to buy it, thankfully. I got saved by employment status.
Okay, so now we've got to talk about Anthony's pick, and then we've got to try and recap it. When I was watching it with the intention of not letting somebody else recap it. But we're going to be talking about Virus Buster Surge. So, Virus is a 1997 Sega Saturn adventure game from Hudson, Sega, and Avex that was a mix of animation and CG. It featured animation from Tatsufumi Tamagawa and Sashi Kagawa, with monsters designed by Tokusatsu monster designer Yasushi Nirasawa. A few months after the game's release, an anime version was launched on TV Tokyo produced by Plum. And as far as I can tell, none of the animation staff from the game crossed over with the anime. With them instead going for Masami Obari.
And he is all over it.
Yes, and none of the game setting or plot is in the anime either. I believe character names have carried over, but very little else. 2 years later, there was a PlayStation fighting game, Virus Battlefield, based on the anime version rather than the adventure game. And from the old licensing site from the show, they describe it as thus: a futuristic society. Everyone is connected to computer networks. This is the story of a virus that has been developed specifically to change humans into monsters by affecting the DNA composition of their brains that are connected to the networks. Stand takes action against the viruses, but one scientist has already started the havoc before he is caught and executed.
That's a lot more story than is in the actual episode.
That is true. This is for the entire... This is trying to get the... You're an anime company in America. You want this cool series to...
You want this really cool, violent thing, don't you?
You're an anime company in the UK. You want to license this and never put it out until years after you announced it. So this originally aired on Thursday, October the 2nd, 1997, at 25:15. So we had this discussion earlier. While technically that's the Friday, nobody was going to say, oh, I've got to get up early on Friday to watch Virus.
Jesus.
So really, it's still Thursday. So I would have been, let me do the maths here, 22 years old at this point.
Yeah, I'd have been 12.
There you go. So I would have been allowed to stay up late enough to watch this. Anthony's picked another one of these ones where he would have never been allowed to watch it in the first place.
I think this is around the time that I managed to... I had my own account at the video rental store, and so I basically just frequented that constantly. This is around the time that I managed to get a copy of Monty Python's Life of Brian and broke my brain as a 12-year-old.
I don't know when I would have seen that. I'm sure I would have been made to watch it by parents.
Or I watched it of my own accord, and it was just like, this is weird. And then my parents were like, oh, you probably shouldn't have watched that. And it's like, well, too late.
See, I wasn't going to get those new Monty Python Blu-rays because I was like, I bought Monty Python. I've got the DVD set. I don't need to go and buy it again. But then I was reading a review where they say, oh, you got this high def remaster. You can now see visual jokes that you couldn't see before. In like the backgrounds of sketches, I was like, oh.
Yeah, they did tons of that, and then it's like, oh yeah, we didn't have the resolution for that, yeah. So, idiots.
So now I'm tempted to get a blooming expensive network Blu-ray. We shall see. I'm holding back on Blu-rays after importing Giant Robo, so that's gonna happen.
Oh, I got to do that. Shit, damn. Oh.
Well, I had to buy a multi-region Blu-ray player to actually watch it as well. That's the expensive part of that equation.
See, the lucky thing for me is my main Blu-ray purchase recently was the Sentai Filmworks sale on Right Stuff, and they don't region lock anything, so it works on my PS4.
Yeah, I did the PS4 test, and I was like, oh no, this is one of their ones which is region locked because it's sometimes discotheques aren't. But I feel like they've. I remember when they used to sell stuff on eBay to the UK, and clearly someone had put their foot down at some point because they stopped.
Someone had figured it out.
Yeah, someone, one of the licensors. So, yeah, hang on a second. You already got the license to sell it in the US. What do you think you're playing?
Yeah, maybe they had their camphor moment when the licensor were like, hey, wait, what are you doing?
So what was Anthony watching? Cause I would have been at work. Yeah, I'd have been at work in 97. I'd left university at this point. He would have been watching, he may have watched Funny Bones, the Griff Rhys Jones skeleton cartoon.
Oh yeah, God, wow. Man, I remember that.
Yeah, dark, hell, yeah. Play Days, probably wouldn't have been watching. To be honest, he wouldn't have been watching this because he'd been watching, like you, Satellite something. The Silver Brumby, the animated adventures of Thalra, a magnificent silver cult. That looks like an OCR error. So I don't know what that is, but assume it's some sort of horse. The Silver Brumby, indeed it is a horse. By goodness, that cartoon looks terrible. Mr. Why Me. Four of a five-part comedy drama. I think drama's probably over-egging it. I did look what this was. It's set in an old folks' home where a kid's been sent to stay there while his parents are away, and it's being run by an authoritarian matron played by Annette Badland, and she's ordered a Mr. Wyme, which turns out to be a robot, or an android rather, and very weak comic hijinks ensue.
Yeah, that's a wild premise, though.
It's a very anime premise, to be honest. Like, the parents have gone away abroad and you're sent to go and stay with somebody.
Well, it's the not as aspirational version of having the house to yourself. You get sent to live in a nursing home instead.
But you get an android out of it. Then you got Smart, the art series with Mark Spate and Josie Darby. News round, Biker Grove. Cher gets a nasty shock from Harry. Karen stirs up the feud between Rob and Terry. Ed goes competition mad.
The last line is the good one. Just like, oh, we've remembered a different plot line.
Yeah, the last line's always like the least serious plot of the kids' soap opera.
Yep.
And then you got Neighbours, and in the evening you got Watchdog, EastEnders, and our sex offender appearance of the episode, Animal Hospital with Rolf Harris.
Whoops. I would have been watching Animal Hospital because my mum always took the remote off me and watched that thing.
And that was followed by really depressing comedy Dad with George Cole and Kevin McNally. I seem to remember that being pretty depressing. It was like, is George Cole's character... Oh, it's not. No, I think Dad's fine. I'm thinking another one. I'm thinking the Richard Briers one, where he appears to be senile. I think Dad's fine on that front. It's not so bad. And then I think BBC Two was mainly Labour Party conference recaps. The UK number one was Something About the Way You Look with Candle in the Wind by Elton John.
Oh yeah, 97. This would have been post Diana getting owned.
Maybe I wouldn't have been at work, but no, the funeral wasn't that day, so that was a weird day. Like, not coming into work because a royal's died.
Well, there's a way to get more holidays then, get the guillotine out, you know.
potatoes must cease. So, this episode, what was it called? I've done a very poor job of getting the episode titles this week. Virus, episode 1. It was called... oh dear, that's not helping me at all. There's so many animations about viruses. Some of them actually about viruses. Here we go. Episodes for Virus Buster Surge. That classic 1997 anime. Cutthroat Puppets is what it's called.
Yep. Also, in the video I watched, it was misspelled, but in a way that made it seem more extreme. So, it felt more of its time already.
Your director, character designer, screenwriter, and storyboard for this episode is Masami Obari.
Wearing entirely too many hats.
I think just about the right number of hats. The series composition, though, is by Jiro Kanako, who hasn't got many credits in anime, and Kazuhiko Soma, who would go on to do a similar role on Beyblade. And the last anime they did was Tetsuko's Journey, I think in 2007. I think they just moved into video games and novels and picture books and things based on their website.
Well, that's where the money was going at that point, so why not?
And our opening theme is by Dragon Ash, Rainy Day and Day. Dragon Ash were formed in 1996 and thus by law are a new metal band. A year after Virus, they would have their first million seller, and they would also have another anime theme, this time for another post-Evangelion show, DT Atron. If I remember correctly, that's the What If Shinji Was Tenchi.
Oh, God. Ugh.
I think that's the one.
Jesus. Talk about a cursed fucking premise.
It's more just the visuals, more than anything else. Ending theme is by Ran Takano. It's called Heavenly Blue. And again, they're another person who I can find no information on.
It's highly forgettable, so I can kind of see why.
Whereas the opening is like, it's memorable partly by the music and partly because they decided we're going to show how cool and edgy we are. We're going to make the opening widescreen, even though we don't have the technology to really show it on your TV. So when it goes to DVD, it's going to have, it's going to still be in 4x3.
It's going to be real fucking tiny.
Because the rest of the show is in 4x3.
Yeah. And the intro, like, is kind of, I don't know, the intro is extremely of its time, you know, because you, as you mentioned, the band and the song are pretty atrocious, but they're very of their time. And also it does the whole thing where it brings up the different characters and shows them at their work or doing something and then gives you their name. And so right from the off, you know, you're up for something like late 90s, edgy, like pointy chins, strange chin bulges of jawbones and stuff. So you know what you're getting right from the off.
You say late 90s, however, my first thought when I saw them in their armor was Borgman, which sets it very far back to 1990.
Yeah, it's got this, I mean, the main thing for me is when, like, obviously the female characters turn sideways and their, like, cheekbones jut out their head, like they've got some kind of eye tumor. Like, it's got that little, bit to it, which I can never really shake.
Yes, these are very Masami about it. There's like a Celine lookalike in the opening credits and in, Sergei's dreams at the start.
Yeah, that was weird. That was a really weird bit. Like, psychosexual dreams to start your anime series off. Also, you've got the most important part is the characters, like gender dimorphism of uniforms. In particular, the girls have very tight tops that have pockets right on top of the boobs. So they've got individual, like, pen pockets on each boob, which just make, it just looks so funny. I don't know. It's like, well, nothing's going to fit in there because they're already, it's so stupid. I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. That's the first thing I remember about the series is boob pockets.
That's true. Well, the first thing I remember is because we get like shots of like each of the characters and their names. And there's one whose look can be best described as leather fetish cop.
Yeah. 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 And there's also like Raven, who is like from The Crow, who is like their commander, who is far too cool for anyone.
That's true.
Who also clearly knows what the hell's going on. Yes,
maybe a baddie. We don't know. Certainly Serge, our main character, who is certainly not the main character in this episode, thinks that he is a bad guy by the end when he finally shows up.
Yeah, and most of it is people speaking to him or exhorting him about things, and then he just goes and does a thing at the end. But anyway, getting ahead.
So we open with Serge having, as you say, some sort of psychosexual dream. And then he gets a phone call, and then we cut to Stand. I don't Stand yet. There's like a TCP, I assume that's Tokyo City Police.
Yeah.
Are dealing with some sort of virus infection of they call them armored gears in the
armored gears, yeah.
They call in Stand, and all of the Stand members are like, "This doesn't seem like a job for us. What are you up to, Raven? Why are you calling us in? We're all busy doing our non-cop things. And you're calling us
our
in."
Our character introduction vignettes. Yes.
And then they get into their super badass machine.
They become Night Sabers.
Yes, and then they become metal heroes. This is why this is so 90s. It's not just Nobari, but it's the idea of a bunch of animators who really liked 80s metal hero shows and wanted to do their own tokusatsu stuff, but within anime.
We're too late. Yeah.
They all show up, as you say, very much like the Night Sabers. You get all the ridiculous establishing shots of the armor and also the boobs in case of the one female member of the team who armors up. They've also got like a...
An analyst at the base.
Yeah. They have the two Masami Obari women's haircuts, the pigtails and the other haircut. And they managed to rescue the guy. The cop is trying to fight the thing and he starts getting infected as well. They defeat it. They rescue him. They take him back, get him healed up. And then they're like, "Oh, he's healing up incredibly well." After the eye catch, the sexually suggestive eye catches, and then we go back to Serge, where he's meeting up with a street dealer, and he's buying like a legal copy of, is it the armor that the good guys wear, or if we assume
I think so, yeah. Yeah, that were information about it, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
then they're doing some analysis on the virus, and they start panicking. Raven gets called away to a demonstration of some new armor, just so Obari has some more robots to draw. Then the female one of the team shows up to try and arrest. This is the pilot who they rescued. Is now going to be testing this, and she's like, "Step away from the armor, or I'll shoot." And then he goes berserk and transforms. Meanwhile, Surge has also come in disguise and is here. Ship blows up. He's now turned into a big old monster set of armor. The good guys arrive. Surge crashes through the ceiling. Rather than fight the monster, though, he goes to fight Raven. Dodges all of Raven's bodyguards, judo throwing them, and then stabs Raven. And then Raven's like, what's he say? He's like,
I have love for you or something.
Yes, it's like, he basically seems to be accepting him.
Oh, you are loved here, then, yes. Basically. I guess the implication is that, like, Raven is someone from Surge's past that he holds some kind of weird grudge for.
Yes.
And also Raven spent most of the episode, when not doing his job, basically as like saying, oh, it's about time, like as if he expects this to happen.
Yeah, there was another vaguely sinister woman who is having vaguely sinister talking to at some point during the episode. And then there's a massive explosion behind them, and you have to wait till next week to find exactly what's going to happen. To be continued, yep. As it says. And then you get your very Lane-like ending credits, but that might just be the video release version.
So this one I watched dubbed, and it has like the quintessential like annoying female voice actresses, which kind of becomes even more galling when the analyst lady basically lays out basically every last thing that the series is drawing from, where it explains DNA and RNA, that tries to explain it back to cyber stuff, and you're just like, oh, okay, this is like everything in the 90s that everyone was panicking about shoved together. Cool. Yeah. The virus is a real virus, but it's also biomechanical and invading people through implants, blah, blah, blah. Here's some robots. And there you go. And so that's why the guy goes berserk the second time. Poor guy. So, but yeah, it's, I don't know. I kind of liked it, if nothing else, but if no other reason than it's dumb and doesn't really care about it being dumb. Like, the fight scenes are kind of cool. It's got the robot designs. Raven, like, is clearly up to no good in some way, but whose side is he on? But also, it felt like the single most Saturn Dreamcast era video game thing, because of the music constantly going out throughout it, that just smacked of that era exclusively. Like, it felt like I was, like, a non-interactive Saturn game or something, which, again, matches its origins.
Yeah, I did look at some video of the game, and it looks very different. It does have that weird, it'd be like a CG background and animated characters, I assume you're controlling them in some way, doing, like, downhill snowboarding. But again, very 90s. Yeah, I agree. It feels like, whereas like Lane feels like it's, I am saying something very serious here about the nature of this world. This thing feels like, what if computer viruses were actually like real viruses?
Well, it kind of sets its own tone up right at the start when it has this like call and response style zoom in on the Earth while throwing out terminology and what might be the show's version of explanation, but they're kind of disjointed, so it's just a call and response that between a female and a male voice that is clearly trying to make the series sound ominous, but comes off just like a Wikipedia entry that got scrambled. But at the same time, like, I don't know, it was extremely watchable just because it was just robots and constantly moving. And then of course it brings up the main character Surge has a cool vintage motorbike, because of course he has a vintage motorbike. You have to have a vintage motorbike to be cool. So, and on that goes.
And you have to have a motorcycle to be a tokusatsu hero as well.
Precisely.
Yeah, because one of them's got, like, blooming Kamen Rider antennae in the first place. That was the hard problem. It's like, of the two men, I couldn't really tell which one was which once they transformed. And really, the show was not interested in either of them once they transformed.
Yeah. Like, if anything, they never seem to get proper screen time, because you could never really... whenever they're on screen, you can't pick them out, even when they're on their own. It's like, which, because one of them introduces him and he's like blonde, but he's got a giant chin and he's always so close to the camera that you can't tell who he is. Yeah. It's like, oh, this guy is, no one cares.
No, it felt a bit like Obari wanted to draw the two women a lot in the episode, and he did. He'll be satisfied with drawing the guy in the cop hat lying across like he's a male model in stills, but beyond that, yeah, not much.
Well, yeah, because in some of his like poses, he looks like he has cleavage, and I'm like, is that another woman? Oh no, it's just the male character who's a model. Yeah. But yeah, the two female characters. It almost accidentally, in fact, I'm going to say it is accidentally, but accidentally, the two female characters end up doing most of the actual work and development in this series because they talk so much together, and it actually comes off quite nice because they're not talking about dudes, even though they're mostly techno babbling at each other.
Main disappointment is we didn't get the villain who is played by the aforementioned Kazuki Yao, and I'm going to guess the fellow who did Trigun and Blood Buckeye Battlefront, the recurring villain in Blood Buckeye Battlefront, there's a striking resemblance to the villain in this. Mm. The villain apparently is called Brain Lizard.
Ugh. Okay, sure. Gross.
Which I was trying to find pictures of him, and all I could get was like diagrams about this is how the lizard brain works. And I was like, okay, I need to add virus to this as well, in order to get the picture to come up. And I was like, okay, that's what he looks like. But I assume he's the guy who was executed, and this is his plot. But yeah, it feels very much like a tokusatsu show. Like, this is... people are turning into monsters. This is the way these people turn into monsters. Here are our superheroes who are going to try and prevent the people from turning into monsters, but inevitably they won't quite get there in time, and they'll have to beat them up instead.
Yeah,
it was fun. I'm tempted to watch more, but there's more things I need to watch in the current day. And I would say, of these three, though, the one I would send back to my childhood self would be Might Gainer.
Yep, same.
I think that's the one I like the most. And that's the one I'm more interested to see more episodes of. Because Virus Buster Surge, it's got like you can see an ongoing plot from the first episode where you can't really see it in Might Gainer. But what you have in Mike Gainer is that ending credits with those four of the weirdos plus the weirdo we just saw. So we know he's going to be back. And I want to know what that madman who looks dressed like a samurai is all about. Because that's right up my street. I was kind of worried at Danku after Danku. It was like, don't let this be one where all three of these are going to be bad. But I was actually quite happy watching Gainer and Virus. So all those people who say Virus Buster Surge is terrible, come on, unless it takes like a really bad turn on episode two, which is entirely possible.
Yeah, it could take a bad turn at any point, frankly, given its introduction.
But no, that was a satisfying first episode. I think probably because it was so Masami Obari. But yeah, I'm not sure it's the most Masami Obari thing, but it did feel very 90s.
It felt like a Sega Saturn Dreamcast game come to life in anime form, with everything good and bad to do with that. Like, the soundtrack especially is so fucking wild that I was watching it going like, damn, like, this is of its time, and it's having a load of fun.
Yeah, that, I think the fun thing is the thing, because some of those 97, 98, 99, 2000, 2001 anime feel like they're not having fun. They're doing it because Evangelion did it, and they feel like they can try and not be as popular, but they can like catch like the people who want a little bit more of that. And yeah, not all of them feel fun. The weirdest one is a comedy. God, what's it called? Where the opening is so Evangelion, even though the rest of the show is not. It's about a girl with drill hair. D4 Princess, that's the one. But there's the possibility someone will pick that in future, so we can talk about it more then. But I was going through, because I was grabbing all the first episodes to future podcasts, so I was like, so look at this. I was like, why is the opening like reminiscent of Evangelion when it's a goofy comedy about a girl with drill hair? very strange, but that's kind of, I guess we're seeing all the Kimono Friends clones appear this year, so. Or the one, not necessarily clones, because some of them pre-existed, but they get an anime because Kimono Friends was a success. Have you checked any of those out?
Yeah. Which, if anything, is like chasing lightning in a bottle. Like, good luck. I mean, all the best to you, but, like, even Kimono Friends could not do Kimono Friends again. So, like, why are you... It sounds mean, but why are you trying? Stop.
Well, I believe one of them's trying is because a load of zoos are partly involved in order to try and get more zoo tourism going. But yeah, I'm not sure. Uchitama, I guess that's based... That's got the advantage of it of having the Tama and Friends franchise pre-existing. So, but yeah, it's that set on Academy is the one which is clearly trying to capture that again, because that's the one with the zoo involvement, where all these wildlife parks and zoos are behind it. It's like, this will get nerds to come to the zoo, and we can get that nerd money, all because a stupid penguin fell in love with a cardboard cutout. Anything to plug, Elliot?
Well, yeah, I have a manga podcast, Screen Tone Club. You can find it at screentone.club. We're actually recording in like an hour and a half, and I need to finish my reading up for it. But yeah, it's a good old fun time with me and my friend Andy as we talk about manga series. We also, because we have a Patreon, because we're a podcast in the 2000s, and our lovely listeners keep making us read light novels because they hate us, I guess. I don't know. Please stop. I'm going to have to read Spice and Wolf this month, so hooray. It might be all right. Who knows? It's been an education, that's for sure. But yeah, you can pop along and listen to that at screentone.club. Highly recommended.
That reminds me, I've got a light novel I should really read by next week, but that's not going to happen. I picked up the Dirty Pair one.
Oh, cool. Secondhand. That's good.
And it barely looks secondhand at all. Because next week will be our final original Dirty Pair podcast. We are going to wrap up the last few bits of the remaining original Dirty Pair anime that we haven't watched yet, or at least haven't podcasted about yet. And we'll be joined, hopefully, by Bradley and Gary, and hopefully Anthony is back, to talk about the Dirty Pair OVA series, those final 10 episodes. And then we'll have to discuss doing Flash. Otherwise, be back here, just subscribe on all your usual subscription things. We'll eventually get our Patreon going as well. I need to talk to Anthony about that. We've got the plans. I mean, you can go to the Patreon already, but you're not getting anything for your money at the moment. You're just giving us money. But we're going to put a bonus podcast up on for Patreon users, donators, patrons even. Those are the words you use.
There you go. You found it.
I'd have got there eventually. It's increasingly like that. It's like taking a long route round to find the right word. We'll have another one of these, though, I believe, in a fortnight's time. We're going to try and do more the anime that didn't make us this year, because that seems to be a good format, and it only involves us watching about an hour or 20 minutes of anime a week, which is a lot easier than now to have to watch 3 hours of Dirty Pair. No, hang on, did the maths. 5 hours of Dirty Pair.
Plus it helps that if you don't like one series, you've got another one coming up, and it's a different series.
Yes, and there's like a big enough gap in the times normally. I just need to find people who could have watched anime in 1987. I think that's like the one gap we've got. Who do I know who was born in 1980? I'll have to bother Gary about it if he's on the podcast next week.
I was about to say, and my co-host on the Spanker podcast, Andy Hanley, was born in 1979, so getting there.
There you go. Yeah, I also need to bother John, but I think he's got a kid, so he probably does not want to be podcasting. Or if we do podcast, there's going to be a baby crying in it. At the same time. Righty-ho. That is everything for this week. We'll be back next week with more podcasting. Goodbye.
Goodbye.